Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 15th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, tracking single T cells, SARS 10 years later, and a look at the policies governing geoengineering.
We may find ourselves in a situation in a few decades where it's really essential to begin deploying climate engineering technologies to slow or stop or reverse bad changes that are underway.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
In the immune response, when CD8 T cells recognize invaders, most of them act in the short term, clearing the pathogen out. But some of these cells stick around in the form of memory cells to provide a more targeted and aggressive response if the pathogen ever shows its face again. In two Science Express reports this week, researchers reveal what happens on the single cell level to create diverse yet reproducible populations of memory and effector cells. I spoke with Carmen Gerlach about her group's effort to examine the population dynamics and single cell fates in these immune responses.
What we wanted to understand is why T cell responses to a particular infection are so reproducible, and mostly when it comes to the response magnitude and also to T cell differentiation. To address this, we actually tracked the fate of individual naive T cells in response to an infection and then found that the response of these individual cells are not the same at all. So some T cells produce much more progeny than others, and also the contribution of the progeny towards short-term and long-term protection was actually very different. So that means then that the reproducibility we see in T cell responses, that is only achieved when you actually combine the progeny of many different naive T cells into a population average.
Okay, so let's talk about T cells. What is their typical response to an infection?
Yeah, so the mouse has something like 100 to 1,000 naive T cells, and they can all recognize a particular part of a pathogen.
What does naive mean here in this context?
So that means that they have never seen the pathogen they are reactive to. So short after infection, all the cells which recognize this pathogen get activated, so they're not naive anymore. They start to divide, and by division, they produce a pool of something like 10 to the 7th T cell that all are reactive to this particular infection. But when the pathogen is cleared in the end, then the majority of these activated cells dies again, but not all of them. So you remain with something like 5 or 10% of these 10 to the 7th cells you initially had. And these cells that persist, they will form long-lived memory cells. So they are the ones that then can provide protection once you get infected with the same pathogen again.
Well, why is the reproducibility question important?
Yeah, so when you get infected, you want a pool of T cells to respond.
Right.
And you want to be protected. So you cannot afford, or an organism cannot afford, to have one time a very limited protection, and another time you have a full-blown response and you don't get sick at all from the pathogen. So there needs to be some kind of some reproducibility in how well you can respond to an infection. And if you have something like that, then you wonder how that is regulated. So how can this be? Mm-hmm. And a very easy explanation is always that all cells that respond just do the same thing, because that would be a very easy explanation how you could always get the same response. Mm-hmm. But apparently that is not the case. It's that the cells all respond in a very different way, and just because you have a whole lot of them responding, you can guarantee this reproducibility.
So in your study, you looked at two different models for this reproducibility of response. Can you walk us through them?
Yeah, sure. We were wondering why the T cell responses are so reproducible. So why do we always get kind of the same amount of effector cells and the same amount of memory cells? And the two models, or actually two hypotheses we came up with, were the following. So in the first one, we would have the reproducibility controlled at the single cell level, which would mean that each naive T cell which recognizes this pathogen would then react in the same way. So each cell would produce the same amount of progeny, and always a given fraction of this progeny would then become either memory or effector. And we also, in fact, like to talk about this in terms of T cell families. So one naive T cell and all its progeny together is something we call a family. So in this model, then all T cell families would behave in a similar way.
So you have multiple naive T cells with the same receptor, and
exactly.
Then after infection, they grow into these families. They divide and they have progeny, and those are the families.
Exactly.
Okay.
So from looking just at the naive cells, because they have the same receptor, you would presume that they all behave in the same way. But what we now found is that they actually don't. So by that, I give already away that the first model wasn't the right one.
Okay, well, what's the second model?
Yeah, so the second model, which then is the one that we found to be true, is that these T cell families behave very differently. So some are very large and others are very small. And also the contribution of these families towards short-term protection or the long-term protection or the memory, that is very different. So some make a lot of memory cells and only fewer of the cells that provide a short-term protection, and for some families it's the other way around.
Okay.
And if you then go back to the reproducibility, this then means that because there is such a large variability between the families, the T cell responses are only reproducible with regard to the size and the distribution of effector and memory cells if you combine the progeny of all those different families. So if you would just have a response of two families, and you would have that over and over again, they would not be reproducible. Only if something like 25 or 50 families respond to the same infection, then you'll have the overall response to be reproducible.
Hmm. Well, so if these cells all have the same receptor, how can you tell them apart?
Yeah, so that is the trick we used. So all those individual naive T cells with the same T cell receptor, we give them a unique genetic tag. And this tag is what we call a barcode. And when then this tagged cell gets activated and starts to divide in response to infection, it will pass its barcode to all its progeny. The new thing we wanted to do now is that we needed to quantify the size of these families because we wanted to compare them. And the way we did that is by second-generation sequencing, which means that we can sequence the barcode sequences we find in a population and, in fact, count how often we find each barcode.
So what did you observe when you actually track the fates of these different families?
Yeah, so first of all, we observed that some families were really large and others were much smaller. So there was this huge variability between the families. And then, does this have any consequences? Does this somehow relate to the differentiation state of the cells? So for that, we first looked at some surface markers, of which we know that they're linked to the likelihood to form memory, and also they indicate the differentiation state of the cells. And we looked whether there was a correlation between the expression of these molecules and the family size. And we looked at three different molecules. One is called CD62L, and we saw a really nice correlation between that expression and the family size. And then in such a way that the families which were really large, they had the smallest fraction of CD62L expressing cells. So because of this correlation, we thought, well, there is maybe a link in how these two are regulated, so the family size and the 62L expression, or actually the loss of CD62L. But for these other two molecules, which are CD27 and KLRG1, so for those, it's also known that they indicate the likelihood to form memory. But we did not see the correlation between family size and the expression of those molecules. So while all of these molecules somehow are linked to the likelihood to form memory and indicators of differentiation state, they don't really seem to be regulated in the same way because they don't correlate in the same way, or some not at all, to the family size.
So is this this balance, or the way these populations shake out, is that something that we'd be interested in manipulating down the line? And would that be helpful for human health or disease?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that is something that people have tried to manipulate for a long time, but then not on the level of families, but on the level of the population. Mm-hmm. So there have been a lot of studies on how the amount of pathogen that is around influences the balance and also the amount of inflammation. But that has always been looked at the population level. And I think now it's kind of time to look at how this works for the families. So do families become maybe more similar if you change something in the
right
type of infection or not?
Very interesting. Okay. How does this finding fit in with what we know about other cell types?
I think the interesting relation is towards stem cells. because stem cells have the same thing that they need to balance between different fates. They have to balance between self-renewal, so they have to make sure that they produce more stem cells when they divide, but they also have to differentiate, because that's what a stem cell does. So now recently, it's a group of Hans Clavers who has suggested that maybe this whole balance is regulated at the population level. So it may be that some of the stem cells only produce further stem cells when they divide, and others, on the other hand, would maybe only produce differentiated cells, so they are lost from the stem cell pool. So only by looking again at the whole population of stem cells, you always keep this maintenance of the balance between stem cells and differentiated cells. And that is then something which reminds me very much of our current data.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Carmen Gerlach, thank you so much.
Good. Thank you.
Carmen Gerlach and colleagues write about T-cell populations online this week. You can read her Science Express report and a companion report by Buchholz and colleagues at www.scienceexpress.org.
Hey, podcast listeners. This week, our show is sponsored by Audible. And I just wanted to remind you about a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And as usual, we're going to give you a few recommendations. Okay, this week I'm going to double down on the nerdiness and pick The Physics of Star Trek. This is a nonfiction book and a topic I've spent a little too much time thinking about. What's your pick, Carrie?
Well, you know, I should note that I may be one of the few science and science fiction enthusiasts out there who has never seen an episode of Star Trek.
Unbelievable.
But I am going to recommend another sci-fi classic, 2001: A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. The best line of the book, not a spoiler, "My God, it's full of stars."
So, podcast listeners, check out these books and more from Audible, and don't forget to get your free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
Geoengineering is a field of research involving large-scale interventions in global systems like climate, particularly in an attempt to halt or reverse global warming. The field is highly controversial, and while more research is needed to predict the risks and outcomes of such interventions, a stalemate in governance is resulting in few projects moving forward. This lack of incoming data is also propagating mistrust by preventing both sides of the debate from accumulating facts to back up their claims. Edward Parson, author of A Policy Forum this week, spoke with me about a framework that he argues will move geoengineering research forward while mitigating risks and enforcing transparency. But first, he gave me some examples of the kinds of interventions that have been proposed.
They fall into two broad classes. There's one group that basically try to reduce the amount of sunlight or solar energy that's absorbed by the Earth's surface. And then there's another group that intervenes in the global carbon cycle to remove CO2 from the atmosphere and put it in some stable, long-lived reservoirs. The most promising ones right now involve spraying light-colored reflective mist or dust or aerosols into the upper atmosphere. Mm-hmm. People have also talked about spraying cloud condensation nuclei just up from the surface ocean, especially at low latitudes, to make more or brighter marine clouds. And then there's a long margin that heads out towards science fiction.
Okay, so you're not here to talk specifically about the science involved in these projects. You want to talk about regulation. And as you say, there's sort of a disagreement over how much regulatory oversight there needs to be involved in this kind of research. So what exactly is the problem here? Is it that globally we need better, newer regulations, or is it that we just need to enforce our current regulations better?
It's some of both of those, but it's more that we need new governance procedures or regulations than it is that we need to better enforce existing ones. The controversy over these technologies in general has translated into a controversy over the regulation of research that has the effect right now that a lot of research that's really needed isn't going ahead. Hmm. That's partly a consequence of the fact that there aren't any current international laws or controls on this stuff. So if you look only legally right now, if the United States or some other nation decided to develop a program to do climate engineering, they could in fact proceed to do it and authorize research over their territory or over the high seas, and there's no international law that says they can't.
And this lack of proper governance not only discourages many researchers from getting involved in these kinds of projects, but it also leaves the door open for rogue projects to come in and potentially be dangerous.
Almost, yes. It's not that anybody has done any dangerous experiments, but there are some people who have done experiments that are uncontrolled, low scientific quality, and kind of slipping between the cracks of existing laws and regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of controversy last summer when a promoter basically put together private financing to do an experiment in ocean fertilization off the coast of Canada.
Right.
It was never subject to peer review because it raised money based upon a promise of operational benefits. It was a very scientifically, basically, worthless activity. It wasn't that it was dangerous, but it was an indication of the kind of Wild West environment that exists right now. And that seems to be a rather perilous situation.
And you argue that much of the discussion that's gone on about geoengineering has lacked specificity and concreteness. It's been too general to be really effective. So what do you think are the questions that should be asked and the aims that should be taken into account to make these discussions more constructive?
The discussion so far has got stalled because there's been kind of a polarization between one view that says, this stuff is so dangerous and poses so many risks, particularly risks to kind of sensible, sound management of climate change, that it should be banned or it should be aggressively restricted. And then another view, another group of people who say this is really an issue of freedom of scientific inquiry, government, especially international governments, should butt out. We should just do it like normal science with no additional restrictions. We argue that we need something in between these, because even if each individual experiment is tiny in the actual environmental risks it poses, what they're doing is testing and developing a capability for global scale interventions to modify the climate. And there's a real legitimate public interest in knowing what's going on and exercising scrutiny and control over research that has such huge implications.
Mm-hmm.
So we argue that there needs to be consultations and discussions between governments and scientists to help develop the outlines of near-term research programs that would be low in risk, high in scientific value, and socially and publicly and politically acceptable. And we propose a couple of specific initiatives to help map out the outlines of that governance system.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about a few of these initiatives.
We say there should be an agreement on two widely separated thresholds of scale and consequently expected risk of climate engineering interventions. There should be agreement on a large threshold that should be subject to a moratorium. And a moratorium means the participating governments and the participating scientists agree we won't do this. Then there should be a second, smaller scale threshold, quite widely separated from the big one, so we leave a big gap in between these. And research smaller than this scale needs to go ahead, has scientific merit, and should be allowed, subject to normal scientific application and peer review processes, plus some modest additional regulatory burdens, which are really quite modest and are mostly of a matter of transparency.
And the way this would all work, according to your plan, would be essentially governmental authority over all of this kind of research. Many scientists bristle at that notion.
Yep.
How will these policies appease both policymakers and scientists, do you think? Is compromise possible?
Well, it is a compromise proposal. I mean, you can imagine extreme factions on either end, one saying absolute unrestricted freedom of inquiry, and the other saying, no, these technologies pose too many risks, and you can't even research them. We argue that government authority over even small field research on these things makes sense because even small field research has big implications for future capabilities to engage in operational interventions to change the global climate. Now, governments already exercise authority over research
right.
by funding research programs and overseeing the peer review processes by which program managers decide what research to fund and what research not to fund.
And an interesting point that you bring up in the paper is that many research projects get a lot more scrutiny than their non-research counterparts? I mean, for instance, if we're talking about injecting aerosols into the atmosphere, people get very scared at the notion of geoengineering research that would do that. However, we have all these commercial airlines that are doing that all the time, every day.
Right, right. And this is a big reason for kind of the core of the compromise we proposed. One of the reasons for this is that if you say you can't do any geoengineering research, but there are regular commercial and operational activities, shipping, aviation, other stuff, that are every day imposing environmental perturbations that are of the same scale or bigger than any research project, what you're basically doing is saying you want to control this activity by virtue of its purpose or the fact that it's called geoengineering.
Right.
And that doesn't make sense. It not only doesn't make sense in terms of management and environmental risks, it also poses all kinds of temptations for people just to dissemble about what they're doing and what the purpose is.
So in the bigger picture then, how do you see these proposals making it from this paper, this policy forum, into constructive discussions and eventually achieving global buy-in?
We think the proposals we're advancing represent some real concrete first steps that can actually bring benefits and advance the debate. We also hope that government officials who are running research agencies and designing programs will pay attention and take these proposals seriously. Mm-hmm. We also expect our proposals to help establish some comfort and channels of communication and shared understandings among governments about the need for transparency and about cooperative approach to these technologies. Because if future climate change turns out really badly, we may find ourselves in a situation in a few decades where it's really essential to begin deploying climate engineering technologies to slow or stop or reverse bad changes that are underway. And we don't know anything right now about how governments would make decisions about how to do that, how to go ahead with it, how to control it, who's in charge, without coming to really severe risks of conflict. So we think it's crucial that they start talking to each other early on while the stakes are low, so that if we do come to such a frightening climate future, there will be cooperative decision-making channels established, and it won't be a cascade of provocative actions taken by one great power or another, because the risks of that would be terrible.
Absolutely. Well, Ted Parson, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for talking with me.
Edward Parson and co-author David Keith write about ending the deadlock in geoengineering governance in a policy forum this week.
Ten years ago, SARS, or Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, began to quietly circulate in southern China. When SARS finally reached Hong Kong, only a quick flight separated it from every other part of the planet. In all, the virus infected about 8,100 people in 30 countries, 774 of whom died. With a mortality rate of almost 10%, the epidemic galvanized researchers and the global health community. I spoke with Dennis Normile about what we know now, 10 years after the outbreak.
Anytime there's an unusual disease or a new disease in circulation, researchers will jump on it and try to find out what it is. And so even before this had really spread worldwide, researchers in Hong Kong and in China were trying to find out what was causing the disease. And then later, after the WHO, the World Health Organization, issued its global alerts that this new disease was spreading, the WHO put together a network of laboratories. It was around the world, in Europe, in the U.S., and in Hong Kong. And they were sharing information in a conference call every day. Almost simultaneously, three labs independently concluded that a new coronavirus that had never been seen in humans before was the likely culprit. And that identification was later confirmed by laboratory testing on animals.
Well, let's talk about the involvement of animals in this disease. There are a couple of different possibilities in play as scientists started to solve this puzzle. They looked at civets, raccoon dogs, and bats. Which proved to be important?
First, I should explain that in Guangdong province, there's some unusual culinary traditions. The people there like to eat wild game, and this includes beavers, rabbits, small deer. And there's a big trade in these wild animals. And so some of the first SARS cases were linked epidemiologically to this wild game trade. Once the SARS virus was identified, researchers from Hong Kong went to one of the live animal markets in Guangdong and looked for this virus by taking samples from animals that were for sale. And they found that the virus could be retrieved from civets, primarily, and also from a raccoon dog. However, later, they could not find the virus in any wild civets or any wild raccoon dogs. And so that indicated that there was still a reservoir somewhere out there in nature that had not been discovered. And it took several years after the outbreak when two groups independently and almost simultaneously reported finding a very closely related but not identical virus in bats. And so it's now assumed that bats are the natural reservoir of something close to the human SARS virus. But it's not known how the virus got from bats to civets to humans. So there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
So, and what about the mutations involved? What was learned about how this virus came to start being transmitted to humans and harmful to humans?
As I said, it's not clear how the virus traveled from bats to civets or if there was, you know, some other route of transmission. But the virus that was found in civets and the virus found in humans were quite close, although there were some key differences. And the civet virus was never found in humans, and the human virus was never found in civets. But they did zero in on two key differences. And these occurred on what is called the spike protein of the civet virus. And the spike protein is a protein that attaches to a receptor in human cells and uses that as its entry into the host cells. In the civet, there were two particular amino acids that were different from the human version of the virus. And they eventually determined that those two amino acid differences accounted for a very big difference in how strongly the virus spike protein could attach to the human receptor.
Now that the researchers knew a possible route of transmission or source of these kinds of infections, what steps were taken to halt the spread of SARS?
First of all, tracing the virus back through its animal roots was really a separate question, because it seemed that the virus probably just made that jump to humans just once. After that, it was all human-to-human transmission. And it was realized at some point that stopping that chain of transmission among humans would stop the outbreak. It was also realized fairly early on that a very large percentage of the infections were taking place in hospitals. People were getting sick, they were going to hospitals, and then hospital staff did not realize that they were dealing with a new virus. They did not take proper precautions in terms of protecting themselves and protecting other patients and protecting visitors. In the later stages of the outbreak, for example, in Toronto and in Singapore, over 70% of all infections occurred in hospitals. So probably the biggest step that was taken to halt the spread was to introduce proper precautions in hospitals. And this involved isolating SARS patients. It also involved making sure that healthcare workers were properly outfitted so that they would not come in contact with respiratory droplets. There was a lot of information that was exchanged within the worldwide medical community. The hospitals in Hong Kong that had first dealt with this disease, their clinicians and researchers wrote many papers in order to share their experience. The WHO also set up a network of clinicians around the world to share information. And so that was one big step in getting the world medical community to recognize there was a new virus and to recognize how to treat it and how to prevent its spread. Within the community that is outside the hospital, there were a number of steps taken. Perhaps the most effective was simply raising awareness among people. Authorities also traced the people who may have been exposed to a SARS patient and quarantined them. Usually this was voluntary. They were asked just to stay home for 10 days.
Okay. Well, now that we're 10 years out, what are some of the big lessons from the SARS outbreak?
There were a couple things that happened, and some of this was not just because of SARS, but also because of the avian influenza H5N1, which impressed upon the world community the need to rapidly share information about unusual outbreaks of any kind of disease, to as rapidly as possible share patient samples so that the cause can be readily determined. So this need for greater cooperation is probably one of the biggest lessons. In many hospitals now, there's just greater awareness of the need to be prepared and to be ready to protect hospital staff. One thing that several researchers have mentioned is that there has also been a realization that there should not be a line drawn between human health and animal health. SARS helped make it clear that diseases that spread among animals can infect humans and spread to humans and adapt to humans. And so taking a more holistic look at the diseases that are in circulation in animals can result in having an impact on human health as well.
Well, so is SARS actually likely to make a comeback? Are we going to see this virus infecting and killing people again?
Whether the exact same virus comes back is a matter of debate. At this point, the virus that was the source of the 2002-2003 outbreak, it only exists in laboratories, as far as we know. It's never been found in nature. If the natural reservoir is in bats, the viruses they have found so far would have to go through innumerable mutations to get to the virus that caused the human outbreak. Whether that could all be replicated again is not clear. However, it has been found that bats host many dozens of coronaviruses, many of which are potentially a threat to human health.
All right. Well, Dennis Normile, thank you so much for talking with me.
Okay.
Dennis Normile is a contributing correspondent based in Tokyo. His news focus is part of a package on the 10th anniversary of SARS, which also includes a story by Martin Enserink on the big lessons of the SARS outbreak and a chronology of events beginning in the spring of 2003.
Finally today, Carrie Klein here and online news editor David Grimm is with me to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So Dave, in our first story, we've got an unexpected outcome of the roller derby.
Right. And for those of you who don't know what roller derby is, it's a sport where you have two teams and it's typically women and they're on roller skates and they're sort of racing around a track and one member of each team is basically trying to lap the other team. And every time you lap the other team, you get a point. It's actually a little bit more complicated than that, but that's a simplified version. But one of the interesting things about roller derby is it's a very high contact sport. There's a lot of bumping, a lot of jostling, a lot of falling down. And that was perfect for the authors of this study because they were trying to figure out how we share microbes from person to person, how the microbial colonies that live on our skin get there and how they change over time.
So this is really about a lot more than just the sport of roller derby.
Right. The roller derby provided a nice venue to test this idea of, do we share these populations of microbes when we touch each other, and does that sort of change the population of bacteria on our skin?
So we already know that, you know, the skin microbiome plays a role in immunity, it plays a role in health. You know, what did we learn from this study?
Well, right. And actually, a few weeks ago, Carrie, if you recall, you and I talked about how bacteria on our faces specifically help protect against acne. So these questions of these microbial communities on our skin, they aren't just academic questions. These microbes can actually play a large role in our health and even our complexion.
So what did we learn about sharing these communities?
Well, what the researchers did here was they actually took swabs of the players' shoulders, which are exposed, before these roller derby matches and afterwards. And what they found before, which was really interesting, was that they could tell which team a player was on just by the microbial community on their shoulder. In other words, Everybody on the team had a very similar population of microbes. But after the bouts, the teams had different populations of microbes. So say an average player might share 28% of her microbes with a player on the opposing team before the match, but about 33% of her microbes after the match.
So all players sort of became a little more unified in their microbial communities.
Exactly.
But there are a lot of conditions that both teams are sharing there. You know, the heat, they're all sweating, they're all wearing similar gear made out of similar materials. Could that at all be responsible for
these? It's a great question. And actually, you know, factors like that can influence the microbial communities on our skin, but they usually take a lot longer to change the makeup of those communities. And these changes, the researchers thought, were pretty quick, indicating that when these players are rubbing shoulders and they're bumping into each other, they're actually transferring microbes from person to person.
Wow. So are these long-term permanent changes?
That's a good question, too, and the researchers don't know that yet. They haven't done that work. But they say what it does show us is how easy it is to transfer these communities, and that could give some insight into just how these microbial communities change on our skin over time, and maybe a little bit more insight into the roles they play in health and disease.
Very cool. And in our second story, we've got a new way to determine drug interactions.
And this new way involves Google.
All right.
We seem to use Google for everything. So why not use Google to tell us whether we should be mixing a couple of pharmaceuticals or not? At least that was sort of the idea behind the study. When new drugs come out, the Food and Drug Administration, at least in the U.S., requires that companies run clinical trials to show the safety of the drug. But what often goes unrevealed is how safe it is to use a particular drug with another drug. And often that stuff doesn't come out until a drug is already on the market. People start mixing that medication with another medication that they're taking, and then all of a sudden they start to have these side effects. For example, there's an antidepressant called paroxetine, and there's a cholesterol suppressant called pravastatin. And when you mix those two, it can actually cause hyperglycemia. And that wasn't something that was not identified until after both drugs were already on the market.
So I'm curious about how the internet can be used to actually accurately determine these sorts of interactions. I mean, you know, if I search for side effects of Tylenol, I could find anything that I wanted or anything that I didn't want.
Right. There's a lot of, shall we say, junk out there on the internet, and sort of hard to determine what's real, what's useful information. What the researchers did here was they basically took a ton of information, and so they really wanted to be as statistically significant as possible. And they actually combed a database that had 82 million search engine queries made by about 6 million users in 2010. So they're really trolling through an enormous amount of data here. And they're not just sort of looking for, does Tylenol give me rabies or something like that, you know? They're looking for people that are searching for specific drugs. And then they looked at people that were looking for multiple drugs and a particular side effect. And they were able to correlate all this together. And they found that about 1 out of every 10 people searching for both the drugs, paroxetine and pravastatin, also were looking for terms related to hyperglycemia, things like dry mouth. So people, even without knowing that combining these drugs would cause those symptoms, were already searching the internet for saying, like, I take this and I take this and I'm having this symptom. Hmm. And by pulling out that data, the researchers show that Google is sort of confirming what the FDA only discovered after both of these drugs were on the market, was that the concerns people are having about these drugs are actually revealing about the actual side effects of mixing these two particular drugs.
Interesting. So this isn't necessarily, you know, an effective tool for people who might be worried about symptoms that they have, but it's a good statistical tool for researchers.
Exactly. And what's really nice about this is millions of people are searching Google every day. And there's a bunch of drugs out there on the market right now that we don't know if it's good or bad to combine them. And rather than waiting for a clinical trial or for doctors to make these discoveries after the fact, researchers based on this study can actually start going into Google now looking for these correlations and maybe finding some red flags that they could start testing. And actually what the researchers did was when they were done with this particular experiment, they looked for 62 other drug pairings, half that were known to cause hyperglycemia and half that were known not to. And they found that through their data mining procedure, they were able to correctly predict whether the drug combination did or did not cause hyperglycemia about 81% of the time. So this seems like it could be a really powerful tool for predicting some of the risks of mixing drugs.
Indeed. And speaking of Google, this last story has been all over the internet this week.
This is a story, not about Google this time, but I can find it definitely on Google, about Facebook and what we like on Facebook, what that reveals about ourselves, things like sexual orientation, drug use, even religious affiliation.
Right. So, I mean, I can see how if I like Obama's Facebook page, I'm telling the world that I'm a Democrat. But how can we determine more sort of subtle parts of my personality from
right.
these things?
And there's some very obvious things, right? Just like what you mentioned. What the researchers in this study want to figure out is, are there even more sort of profound aspects of our personality, things that we don't feel like we're revealing when we say like a crazy cat video or like a picture of curly fries that actually are telling Facebook and potentially advertisers what some of our most intimate personality traits are.
So how do we determine this?
Well, the researchers, rather than scanning Facebook, they actually used an app called My Personality, which users could get into, answer a bunch of survey questions, and then the researchers were able to correlate that with their likes data on Facebook, which is public information. And they combined all this into a statistical model. And they found that the like data was very predictive in terms of somebody's gender. It was 93% predictive based on things that people liked, 95% predictive of race when race was limited to Caucasian versus African American, but even other traits that are potentially less obvious, traits like homosexuality, religious affiliation, and even drug use. Some were really easy to explain, like your Obama example. People that liked a lot of things that had to do with Jesus tended to be Christian. So that seemed pretty obvious. There were some things that were a little bit more unusual. There was a strong correlation between liking curly fries, which I mentioned earlier, and having a high IQ. So there were some interesting correlations there. Researchers don't exactly know what they mean, but what they're saying the big deal is here is that we may not really feel like we're revealing a lot about ourselves when we just sort of randomly click that like button on Facebook. But we actually may be revealing a lot to Facebook. And because Facebook shares this information with advertisers, we may actually be sharing a lot of information with advertisers that we don't realize that we're sharing.
All right. Well, maybe I'll dig up that old MySpace profile instead.
Exactly.
All right. And what else have we had on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about how our bones grow and what factors influence the shape of our skeletons. Also a story about whether we are accurately reading our dog's emotions by looking at their facial expressions. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a controversy over supposed life found underneath Lake Vostok, whether or not a new species of bacteria have been found or whether there's really no life at all there. Also a story about numerous cases of plagiarism in National Science Foundation proposals. Finally, for Science Live, this week's Science Live is about arts and smarts, the intersection between science and culture. And next week's Science Live is about emerging diseases. What are some of the growing threats out there in terms of the diseases that can infect us? And what are scientists doing to combat them? So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Gary.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider, as well as Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the March 15th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.